But I want to talk to Kathy first about this is a time where people get through one thing and then they jump into the other. The time of holidays, the time of a lot of shopping, time of business, Thanksgiving. But then there's that moment of after Thanksgiving where we think of shopping. When do people think about Christmas going away and that thing? So I'm going away for Christmas. Do you find that some other people like to travel for Christmas as well?
Yeah, they generally plan for it months out. Mm-hmm. So, but there's that time period. There's that quiet time, like the 1st to the 15th of December. It's like a really dead period. So if you want to go somewhere during that time, it's a good time.
That's an interesting point. So where would you suggest going if someone wanted to take advantage of that dead time where things are kind of not happening before the rush of Christmas?
Mainland, yeah. Mm-hmm. Just if you want to do a quick trip for not too pricey of a cost, then somewhere to the mainland.
How are the prices? I saw Hawaiian Airlines had a sale last week. Are any other airlines doing sales?
No, but they're lower, probably around $400 to the West Coast, sometimes cheaper.
That's not bad at all. I heard that there was a price going to Barcelona, from Maui to Barcelona, for around $500.
Wintertime, I'm sure.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Wintertime, yeah.
It's cold. Well, it's not so cold in
Barcelona. Barcelona is colder, but it's not like Paris, you know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, there might be some good deals if you want to really get away. And sometimes you can spend the same amount on a trip as you would on Christmas gifts if you stayed home.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, it's like, oh, I was away. Sorry, I didn't get time to do Christmas this year. So I went away.
I spent it on myself.
Are there any other sales or good things coming up? Tell us about your deals and options of what's going on out there.
Paul Gauguin, you know, still a good deal, but they don't have any 7 days right now for the Hawaii resident rate. They only have the June 24th. Which is a 12-night, and also August 26th, 11-night. So we're just kind of waiting to see.
Are those discounted rates?
Those are discounted. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The 12 nights for a porthole cabin starts at $22.95. But the problem with that one, when Hawaiian Air comes back on July 8th with the Saturday night, the flight's all sold out right now. So I'm...
Oh, wow.
So you either have to route back through L.A. or I'm hoping something might open up. There might be box space on there.
I'm going to ask you a question that I've heard people talk about. I mean, I've actually heard people say that are friends. When I fly, I book. I think you did this on your Facebook. You book a seat on the window and a seat on the aisle. And I think you said in your post on your last flight, then you said the middle seats are sold last. So if you're going with someone and you book a seat on the window and a seat on the aisle, sometimes you don't get someone sitting in the middle because they sell the middle seats last?
They fill those last. So like if I do it for clients, because I can see the seat map, and then if there's a row that has three in it, then mm-hmm. I do a window and an aisle. And then right at the moment, there's no middle. So nobody's sitting in the middle, and mm-hmm. then many times, not all the times, if it's not busy or you just luck of the draw, no one's sitting there, you get the whole row.
And did that happen with you?
And it did. Oh. And my husband didn't believe me. He didn't like that because he didn't want to sit next to somebody, a stranger. Mm-hmm. And I did it anyways. And we got the whole, from Amsterdam to L.A., we had the whole row to ourselves.
That's a long flight, too. Mm-hmm. It was a direct Amsterdam all the way to L.A.?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's about 11 hours.
That's a long time. So it's nice to have that. I mean, my arms don't fit in a regular mm-hmm. seat. Even if they give you more leg room and I get extended leg room, my arms stick out beyond the natural capacity of the seat.
And then you
and
fight.
And it's really hard to figure out half it. If there's how do you split an armrest in half? It's almost impossible. Mm-hmm. It really is almost impossible. So you try to, I mean, do that, or then you just, either someone gives way. There's all this unspoken body language going on.
Right.
Either you're going to put your arms in and be uncomfortable, or you take the armrest, and the other person is uncomfortable. Right. Or sometimes you can switch, but you can't talk about it. You can't say, can I have the armrest for the first hour and then you can have the armrest?
Excuse me. Excuse me. Sorry.
And if they're really big, there's no choice. Yeah. If you have someone who's really large next to you, they're going to take that armrest. Whether they want you or not, they just extend past the seat width. So you don't have a choice, really. So I'm just saying, you know, it's nice to really try to be practicing aloha. It's really super nice to practice aloha when you're traveling. And I think there's a whole new, I've been seeing this debate come up with a lot of travel magazines. Condé Nast even actually asked someone whether or not you should put your seat back. And there's some people that say it's rude to put your seat back, and others saying, no, I'm paying for a seat that goes back. Why shouldn't I put my seat back, you know? And there's really arguments for both. I mean, obviously, you shouldn't put your seat back till you're supposed to. You're at a cruising altitude of about 30,000 feet or something. But the hardest part is I've seen people put their seat all the way back, and when someone else has a meal on the... And it can really literally take a 45-degree angle in the seat over the food tray. And or, you know, if your computer's up... It's almost impossible with the way the seats are done now, if your seat goes way back, to do that. So I think, and I'd like everyone's feedback here, I think it's okay to, like, do maybe one or two notches. I try to compromise. See, this is an Aquarian thing. We're talking astrology. I try to compromise, and I go back a little bit, but try not to go back all the way. How do you feel about seat back?
I do it a little bit, but when it's during meal service, if there is meal service on the flight, then... I keep it up.
Mm-hmm. So you're trying to be aware of your, yeah. So, Stevie, what's your thing? Seat back or seat up?
I kind of agree with Kathy. If it's mealtime, I definitely keep my seat up or just like a notch back. But after mealtime, I'll kick back if I want to sleep.
Yeah.
But I'll ask, too. You know, if somebody's working on their computer, and you never know. So I'll just kind of like... peek over the back and just ask them if it's hard if I lean back all the way.
So you're not afraid to ask them. I think that's probably a good way to go, actually. Mm-hmm. I, you know, if you can just say, is it okay? Mm-hmm. You know, and it's very hard in some of these seats, if they're straight up, to actually get any sleep. I mean, it's really uncomfortable sometimes.
You're like falling forward.
Yeah, no, so it's kind of like we have to be so kind of full of aloha and awareness when we're traveling. And it's kind of difficult to kind of judge it sometimes on how you're doing. And you can really sometimes unconsciously do it. But there's been fights. There's been fights that have broken out on airlines about people who put their seat back into someone. Literally, one time someone actually strangled the person and put their hands around. I got so mad, you know, because one time someone swore at the other person in an argument. But, I mean, what's happening is people are so stressed out anyway in traveling that they're really not themselves. And you know, they drink sometimes too much, or maybe they're on tranquilizer or something like that. So it's really, you have to be very, very aware and try to be aware and be, you know, thoughtful. But at the same time, you're over-cramped in a small space and everyone on a plane is trying to survive. And the way they've now done these bookings, they maximize the flights so that almost every seat is full many of the times, especially when it's heavy travel time. So just a thought to try to be aware when you're traveling. And I want to, Steve, would you like me to go Facebook Live with you when you tell your story here about your thing, or would you rather just not have that? I tried to ask one time, Kathy got mad because I didn't ask her, and I went Facebook Live.
She didn't get mad.
I didn't get mad.
You said
you
didn't.
I know, that's why I almost asked. Is it?
Is that a visual or just a?
It's visual.
Vocal?
Yeah.
It's visual.
Well, you're vocal already because you're on the radio, so it would give us a chance to. To talk about, okay, so we're going to do Stevie. I'm going to go Facebook Live on this. I had some problem on the last one I did. Stevie, G-A-Y-L-E, and there you are. Okay, so we're going to go live, but you've got an amazing story, Stevie. And I think a lot of people know you have a lot of Facebook friends, you know. Well, you do.
Fair amount.
You've been living on Maui how long?
22 years.
That's a nice long time. So tell us a little bit about your background, what you do, and then how you end up meeting Piero Resta and what happened. First of all, I mean, are you an artist or what do you do yourself?
I work with aromatherapy with distillation of plants, essential oils. I also do body work in relationship to that. And for 15 years, I worked with Piero in his work as an artist.
For those who may not know, because we stream worldwide, Piero Resta was really actually a world-known, renowned, wonderful, fabulous artist. And he had an art studio that I think you actually could write a book about, out in way out there in Calpo, where there were many parties and lots of gatherings and just magical creations that were full of passion, weren't they, in color. Yes. How did you meet Piero?
Well, I met Piero through friends. You know, at we went out to one of his parties one year, but that was long before we got together, and that was the kind of the first time I had met him. And you know, he was wearing a white tuxedo, and it was pretty one of those wild Calpo nights. You know, lots of people, and everybody beautifully dressed, and great music, and under the stars. I mean, you know, it's pretty juicy. You know, the stories.
Mm-hmm.
But and many years passed, because I was definitely in a relationship at that time. And then at one point, we got together in 2000. And I started working with him in his work. I was still doing body work at the time. I was working as a massage therapist at one of the resorts here in Maui, at the Hyatt.
Oh, nice place.
For a number of years. Yeah, it was great.
Lovely, yeah.
Yeah, I had a great experience.
And that's a long way from Calpo.
Well, I wasn't living in Calpo.
Oh, okay.
At that time, I was still living in Kula. Yes. So, yeah, in 2000, we started working together and doing his artwork. I was kind of wanting to get out of body work for a while. I had kind of worked too much doing that.
It's a lot of, takes a lot of strength.
Yeah, it's very physical, but at the hotel specifically, because you have 7-hour shifts. And
oh, that's a long time.
In season, you have to be willing to do those 7 hours. And sometimes you can give shifts away, but or treatments away, but not always. And I my body needed a rest.
Mm-hmm.
So I started working with him, and well, that evolved into a relationship. And we ended up being together for 15 years. I handled more of the, not the sales so much, but more the administrative part. And we just kind of worked together. I didn't really have an official title. I wasn't really his manager or a salesperson or office staff. I kind of, it's whatever came up, you know, we kind of worked together.
That was out in Calpo?
We had mostly Calpo. I lived in Calpo full time for about 3 years, and then moved more back towards Kula side. We had a place in Kula as well. Back
oh,
and
I
forth
didn't know
between
that.
The two places.
Oh, mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. So how would you, I mean, his artwork had such movement and color and passion, didn't it? I mean, his artwork, yes, just really, I absolutely loved it. People probably may not know it, but if they've eaten at Casanova Restaurant, mm-hmm, of course, he's was friends with Stephen, and a lot of pieces up there at Casanova, Piero's pieces. And
yeah, he used
there.
To have Casanovas.
He did?
A long time ago.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. When his mother was here, he had Casanovas, I think, for maybe a year. I'm not certain of the time link, but it was still a pretty wild place, and they had to have a bouncer.
I'm sure.
There was always, apparently, Mama was there. I only know the stories through him and through people who know him from that time.
Before it's Stephen Bunn.
Yes,
oh,
before that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Was that when it was called Rodeo?
I don't know if it was before... I don't know if it was before or after Longy. Longy had it for
that's,
a year
I'd
or two, too.
I'd forgotten. You're right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're very
There's
interesting.
There's a lot of
history. There is history. I heard stories of one time where a horse that actually went into the restaurant and that they used
I heard
to
that
kind
too.
Of... Yeah, you've heard that story. That's a good... So there you were. And for those that may not be aware of it, Piero got ill. And mm-hmm, he was diagnosed with cancer. I think he had cancer that he fought
in
for...
In 2013, he was diagnosed with a lymphoma, and he came through that and went into remission at the end of 2013, and then he had a year of remission, and then it came back in 2015.
Mm-hmm. And at that point, did he started to weaken. Did he still hope that you would go back in remission? It's so hard when you go into remission once, you think, well, maybe it'll go into remission again, right?
Well, you do think that. And of course, the medical establishment wants you to believe that as well, because they want to believe it, you know. Mm-hmm. So they were very positive and very, doing everything they could to help him.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it had a mind of its own.
Mm.
And Piero often referred to the cancer as a level of intelligence, which was interesting.
It's a living thing.
As a living thing, you know, it was, there's quite a few recordings of him talking about the cancer experience and how he felt it was the big C, and how it was a vehicle for people to start developing compassion towards each other, because it doesn't discriminate.
That's true.
Yes.
That's a very good point.
Mm-hmm.
So he passed away when? Has it been a year?
A year ago, September 8th. Mm-hmm.
And you, of course, went through an interesting process which led you to take a journey we're going to talk about. I think everyone's experience with grief is different. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's one way. I think everyone has different experience with it. I mean, I know Elizabeth Kubler-Ross did, I think, the 5 stages of grief, but and I think there's probably some similarities with that. But grief has everyone's interpretation and understanding is different. Also, sometimes depending on how spiritually connected they are to a person and how that bridge is also to a person, it can affect it too. How did you feel?
Well, that's a big question.
Yeah, it is.
I don't know how to answer that quickly. Pierre and I were deeply connected in our souls. I felt we were soulmates, and I felt like it was time for him to go, and that he was definitely ready. He was very full of light when he left, and I had this feeling that he wasn't going to be encumbered in his transition after. And yet, the human part of me, there's a spiritual part of me that understands all of this, right? But then there's a human part of me that where, you know, my life partner just left. And I think a part of me in that moment went with him. So the grief was pretty profound, you know, because I was splintered. I found that day when I first went out to walk after they had taken his body. In that moment, I went down to Baldwin. It was the first time I'd been off the property for a few days. And there were these people walking up to me, beautiful people that I didn't know them well, but they were having incredible messages for me, just as Piero would say them with his language, everything. I mean, they would see me, and this was like moments after arriving. And it happened 3 times within a couple of hours. So it was very, very interesting to kind of feel his presence through other people in such a quick period of time. So it made me sort of not question, but kind of expand my mind around life after death. Because there's a physical death, and yet there were all of these messages and feelings and perceptions kind of flooding in that were so much about being alive.
I don't know if I think I told you the story about my father's death when I was 12, when we were at Maiden Maui. Did I tell you about
No.
my death? Well, my father passed away when I was 12, and he was very, very, very mental. He was a structural engineer into higher calculus, and my mother was the opposite. But he didn't really believe in life after death, I don't think, but he had talked about it to my mother. He died in his sleep, but 3 days afterwards, he came to my mother, kissed her on the forehead, and said, "There is a forever." And my mother, you know, really felt it, got the message, and then she began looking into life after death. And that's how I started meditating and doing my practice, because she was going to classes. So I started when I was about 12 or 13, because I started classes with her then. And it's been interesting, an interesting process, of course, since then. But I do understand exactly, you put it so beautifully, but there's the two part. There's a spiritual part that knows that, and then there's the physical part and the emotions. And it that is such an interesting situation you go through, even though if someone even is there with you present, you still go through the emotions, you still go through the feelings, you still go through that person's presence that was with you, just not being there, you know?
Right.
So you, and I think everyone, I hope everyone's aware of the movie, the amazing movie. I don't know if you've seen, Kathy, have you seen the Martin Sheen movie?
The Way.
I haven't.
Oh, everyone should see that. That movie's great. It's out on DVD. You can get it through Netflix. It's a story about, if I remember correctly, it's a story of how a father had lost his son. His son had actually done the walk. And it's called El Capin.
It's called El Camino de Santiago.
El Camino de Santiago. And his son had died in the story. On that walk, and he decides to take that walk as kind of a penance for not spending more time with his son. And it's a beautiful movie that explains to him the process he went through. And I think probably there's been a lot of people that do the El Camino.
Yes.
And but I'm sure after that movie even more have. So when did it occur to you to actually, did you watch the movie and that's what brought it on? Or what brought that trip on?
Actually, I saw the movie years ago and I forgot about it. I just remember at the time that I looked at that, I was like, oh, I'm never doing that.
Because it was looked like it was too difficult or too long or what?
Well, I just, everything about it didn't appeal to me. Carrying a backpack, I didn't do that when I was young. Certainly wasn't going to do it when I got older. So there was, you know, many aspects about that. Walking over the mountain in the Pyrenees, which is where his son died, was, and that can happen pretty easily. So that wasn't fictional.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah, things happen there pretty quickly. So you got to check in the night before you go through the Pyrenees to make sure that the weather is clear for that, because you can't see 2 feet in front of you sometimes, and the edge of the mountain is right there. So
you really can't see that? I mean,
when the
fog
comes in, it's really, really thick.
Wow.
And you don't have guardrails. So, you know, there are many ways to die on the mountain. But so you just pay attention. You ask the locals before you go, and they know. You know, and if you can't go that morning, there's an alternate pass that goes down through a valley. But the splendor is in the mountains, because it's just remarkably beautiful.
What was the impetus to going ahead and doing this difficult journey?
Well, when Piero passed, I was pretty lost. You know, he passed, and then kind of our whole life together unraveled. Home, business, everything kind of went at the same time. So I also hadn't been single for a really long time. I needed to understand how to think in the I instead of the we. So there was, there were moments that I would just wake up and really not know what to do. So I would just walk anywhere in Maui, you know, just to kind of breathe air and move my body. And I didn't want to talk so much. And I found nature incredibly healing. You know, it sounds like a cliche, but you know, there's no judgment. You, the mama can take everything that you give it, you know. So it was so healing for me to be doing that every day that I thought, wow, I need to do more of that. So I was looking for something around 5 or 6 days of walking, you know, with a nice place to stay at the end of the night. And then I got a call from a friend in December, and she said, she mentioned I should try the Camino. So that kind of was like the Camino. I remember the Way. Okay, right. That one. So I started doing some research, and I was already going to be in Europe. I wanted to see his family in Rome, and then I held a memorial celebration for Piero at a hotel in Tuscany that we worked at for 5 years, and he has a really beautiful sculpture there. So there's a lot of his work. And
so you went to Tuscany first.
I went to Rome first, then Tuscany, and then and a few other places, and ended up in Paris with a dear friend of ours. And Margot, and she took me to Vézelay, which is really the beginning of the French Way, the Camino the French Way, and from Vézelay to the opening of the Pyrenees, that's almost 500 miles itself.
Oh my.
So people have a tendency to do these in stages, but it was a big surprise to me that Vézelay was really one of the starts. I was just going to go there for a couple of days because the cathedral there is home to the bones, supposedly the bones of Mary Magdalena.
Oh, really?
That's in question.
Mm-hmm.
But still the energy of hundreds and hundreds of people for thousands of years coming to this one place, you know, to honor her holds that energy, whether the bones are there or not. The belief has infused the cathedral
absolutely
with
yeah.
that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very special cathedral in that the monastic order there is vocally trained. So their vespers are all done in song.
Oh,
and the acoustics were unbelievable. And so I got to receive the Pilgrim's Blessing in Vézelay at 7 a.m. in the morning with the Easter light streaming through the nave and surrounded by the choir and the priest, you know, laying his hands. You know, it was just like, wow. You know,
that must have been
moment.
Amazing.
It was really something special. And it ignited the magic for me because even though I didn't start walking from Vézelay, I got my credential from there. And I saw my first pilgrim there. And I don't know, that just, for me, it just started.
It started the process. Yeah.
It really did. And to have that blessing, I'm not Catholic, you know, but I really, my soul loves ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And the Catholic Church is of ritual, you
yes.
know, and to be
and they sure have some beautiful cathedrals.
I never got tired of it, but I stopped at every cathedral I could, and there's so many.
Well, I'm going to go off Facebook Live. You can listen on koi1110.com because I'm low on battery power. So anyway, you did that, and at this point, you just weren't quite sure what you were going to be doing, right? You were just kind of like, this is going to be going day to day, or what happened after the church?
So I took a train, went back to Paris, then took a train south to Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port, which is really considered the portal of the Camino. Everybody kind of starts there if they're doing the French Way, and then you hike over the Pyrenees, and then you hike west, northwest of Spain, all the way to Santiago, and that's about 870 kilometers. Or 500 miles approximately.
Mm.
So I had the intention to do the whole thing, but I also wasn't going to hurt myself, you know, in the process. So
right.
I had never done anything like this. I didn't know how to do walking sticks or carry a pack or any of those things. So it was really one of those, I guess it was sort of my mantra came to be, when everything changes, change everything. And that's as far of a change as I could get, because it was going to challenge me everywhere, and it was also going to strengthen me if I made it out alive. So I thought that would be a good thing to do, and so I started doing what I do best. I research, and I can find really wonderful things in really obscure places, and started to put together sort of a collection of ideas that I thought would be good and really good places to stay and things to look out for, and as much as you can prepare. And I started walking switchback at Poli Poli to strengthen myself, and I was quite underweight when I started this endeavor, and so I wasn't in my healthiest state of mind or body, but I put it all together and started lifting weights, and you know, to because your backpack shouldn't be more than 10% your body weight, and I was at that time 120 pounds, so
wow.
That was only 12 pounds. And my
That's
backpack
not
was, no, my backpack was like weighing in at like 20 pounds. And I thought, oh my goodness. And I kept trying to shave it down. And I was like, it wasn't happening. So I just thought, well, better gain weight and get stronger. So I kind of went the other direction. And so I got that all together, researching all the different equipment, and because you can't carry so much. So I was looking for the lightest things and things that I could possibly do without, because one of the things that they talk about in one of the guidebooks or many of the guidebooks is that you carry your fears in your backpack.
Oh, and wow. What a great was a thought. I've never, because that explains overpacking. I love that thought.
Yeah, it's great. My car shows that too. In your,
oh my gosh, that's a great quote. I'll remember that.
It's a good one. So it's interesting because at the end of the journey, when I was unpacking, I open my backpack to see what's in there, and there's like 17 plastic Ziploc bags. Obviously, I was afraid it's going to run out of a Ziploc bag. So
it's funny.
Yeah.
So you started the journey when?
I started it May 2nd. And
it's supposed to be a good time of year to go.
It's a good time of year to go. Yeah. Well, the Pyrenees, the pass opens around in April.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the snow's pretty clear by then. You can get through the pass generally. A lot of they call them albergs or refugios. You know, those are open starting April, definitely towards the end of April. They're all open through the Camino. So I really wanted to walk when there was not so many people on the road. Mm-hmm. You know, I was really looking to walk by myself. I had a lot of stories in my mind to sift through, and I really wanted to know how I make decisions in the moment, and are they good ones? And, you know, do I trust the yes inside of me, or do I trust the no? And if there's a gray area, what do I do with that? You know, do I wait, and do I have time to wait, you know, till I feel a yes? I mean, there's just, like, I was really curious to discover me again.
To listen to your inner voice and mm-hmm. then trust it, yeah.
Yeah. So I found that I'm sorry, I kind of lost my train of thought.
Oh, the start there.
So the start, yeah. So everybody starts at St. John, and
is that high up in the Pyrenees?
It is. It's pretty high up. I don't know the elevation offhand, but you have a lot of bustle, a lot of activity. Everybody's very excited about the first day.
The beginning
nervous
energy,
too. You know, yeah. Everybody's you kind of. There's all kinds of things going on, you know, and you're kind of in the middle of where everybody's starting, and it's like there's some people are really, really quiet, especially on the train, and other people are just talking nonstop. They're so excited. They just can't wait to get started. And the first day up, it's straight up.
Ooh.
It's straight up. It's not an easy beginning.
Oh, my.
Yeah, and I booked a night at the Orison Albert, which is kind of at the top of the mountain, not at the top, but it's up a 3-hour walk straight up, and
3 hours straight up is tough.
Yeah, people were smoking cigarettes and drinking whatever and taking coffee and chocolate, and you know, about the third of the way up, you know, because it's challenging. I was okay because I was training on the mountain, so for me it was okay. By the time I got up there, it was only 1 o'clock, but it was gorgeous day, cold and windy. But my person who I stayed with the night before, he's Basque, because gorgeous Basque country and snow-capped mountains everywhere, and the sun was really beautifully warm. So, you know, you could sit out for a moment, but not very long, because the wind was quite bitter. Well, he came and got me and drove around the mountain and took me up where the pass starts, going over the mountain where you go off the road. And he rescued like 4 people already that morning that were, you know, their packs were not right. They were experiencing difficulty with their knees. One person, his back went out on the way. I mean, many different things happen, and you just don't know until you get on the trail, like, what your story's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a little nervous about all of that. I'm like, oh my goodness, what's mm-hmm. what's my story? You know, because I didn't consider that I was that strong yet. Mm-hmm. But I got back there, and there's probably 80 people who stayed in Orson that night. And it's all communal dinner, and everybody, that's your first night staying in an alberg where there were 10 people in my room, and it was a very small room with a very narrow walk between the bunk beds. And
ooh.
It was all women with one man, I think he was from Denmark, and I was like, oh my gosh, how did I end up here? it was kind of shocking because, yes. You know, women, I realized that women just talk, you know, and they're like shouting across the room, they're going through their bag a million times, you know, the makeup, the thing, and running to and from the shower, and the shoes, and up and down the bunk, and that, you know, I mean, this was like going on for the whole time before dinner, and I literally was the last person to come in for dinner because I just needed to breathe for a second and readjust my mind to all of this. And I come in, I sit down. There's not one person who speaks English at my table on my side. I thought, well, that's kind of perfect because I said I didn't want to meet anybody. I wanted to just be alone and do my thing, right? Well, the universe just really gives you what you ask for. But there were a couple people on the other side that eventually, you know, we got into a little bit of conversation, and everybody that night kind of spoke about what they were, why they were walking, or and where they were from. Literally all over the world, all over the world. And a lot of people were in transition in their life. You know, the loss of a loved one. You know, one man actually had a cancer diagnosis just 2 weeks before he started. And he was looking for a sign to keep going. And he went to a beach. And there were scallop shells everywhere. And I don't know if you know, but on the Camino, the scallop shell is like the symbol that you're, as a pilgrim, it's the symbol that you carry on your bean or your backpack. And they sell them everywhere, but it's the symbol of rebirth. And it's ancient. This Camino started, well, they had the earliest written description was from 900 AD. Wow. So it's been around, it's been in use for a very, very long time. And this scallop shell would be something they would collect once they finished the Camino at Finisterre to show that they actually had finished the Camino. And then they would carry it back home going the opposite direction. Well, now we start out with the scallop shell as a symbol that we're actually doing it. And it's a symbol to other people that you might be looking, passing, you know, that you're doing the Camino. So it has significance in that respect. So my shell was given to me by a friend, Dietmar, and inside I drew the tattoo from Piero's foot inside the scallop shell. So that's what I carried as mine. It was more small and special and for me. So this man had arrived at this beach, and it's full of scallop shells. So he took that as a sign that he should go on the Camino, he should continue. And he filled, he went home and got a small suitcase and just loaded it with those scallop shells, and he brought that.
Wow.
On wheels.
Wow.
And as he was passing, I don't know how he pulled that everywhere he did, but you know, as he was passing, he would leave a shell every so often where there would be a sign, like a yellow arrow, you know, pointing the direction, you're still going in the right direction, keep going, you know, and that you look for that yellow arrow everywhere. And it was nice to see the scallop shell because we knew he was still alive and still walking the Camino.
Wow.
So it was like this wonderful message, you know, that was being left along the way. So you find, and in that way, you know, you're always looking for a sign to keep going. And it's almost like the Camino is like a metaphor that you lay over your life, where you are not sure about where you're going or what you should be doing, so you ask for a sign and something comes, and then, you know, inside of you, you have to trust that first instinct of what that sign means to you, because then your mind will tell you something completely different. So
doing the whole trip as you were so intensely, did you find that your mind had a new purpose and it took a little bit off your past and brought you in the moment more?
Completely. And then that's what I was hoping it would do, because, you know, I didn't want to put myself in a life and death situation every day, like on the PCT trail or whatever, but, you know, I liked the idea that I would have this big chunk of time during the day to really be in the moment and focus on my steps and my breath and the wonder around me. My goodness, it's beyond words, really, what you experience when you're out there. And you can't help but be in the moment. And when you're not, that's when you lose your way. You're like, where is that yellow sign? Mm. I haven't seen a yellow sign. I haven't seen a yellow arrow.
Isn't there
kind
of a constant stream of people walking or not?
Yes. This year there was in May. But people find their rhythms.
Mm-hmm.
And so because my intention for most of the time was to be by myself, mm-hmm. very often I would find myself, you know, with lots of time in front of me and back of me before people would pass. Mm-hmm. Not always. Sometimes you were definitely in the crowd. And then other times I took alternative routes that were laid out in the guidebook, or I'd ask a local. And on those routes, I definitely was by myself for long periods of time, which, you know, I felt okay about that for the most part. There was only one time where I was a little nervous. And, you know, when I wanted to lay down somewhere, I was exhausted, and it was on the Meseta, which is like where the wheat fields are grown. So it's like nothing for miles and miles. It's the same thing. You're looking at the same thing for like hours. And I wanted to lay down, and I couldn't because I just felt nervous about being by myself by a riverbank with nobody on it except for local people that know it. And so I arrived to a church, like up on a hill, and I really, that hill was, you know, it was the church was closed. Nobody was there for the day. Mm-hmm. It was in siesta time. But I thought it looked safe up there. So I lay down my pack and lay on the ground, and I'm asleep right away. And next thing I know, I wake up and I feel something, and there's a dog sniffing me, and I'm surrounded by sheep. And I'm like, the dog is like, sniffing. He's like, okay, not a sheep, keep going. And then this sheep comes bounding over the hill, like lands like 2 feet from me, and looks at me with a side eye, looks at me again straight on, and then is like, okay, in the way. And then it shoots off to the right, and then the rest of the sheep coming over follow it. And there must have been a herd of 40 sheep, and I was literally in the middle of it. So that was, you know, there are funny moments like that happen, you know.
How long does it take to do the trail?
It took me 43 days.
Wow.
Of walking.
Oh, whoa. 43. Did you think it was going to take that long? Did you know? Or?
Well, I wasn't sure. First of all, the intention was to finish it, but you never know. So I didn't even send a suitcase ahead to Santiago. I just kind of was like, winging it a bit. The guides, one of the primary guidebooks that people use says you can do it in about 30 days. But that's walking sometimes 30 kilometers a day.
I can't even imagine.
That's a lot.
How much is 30 kilometers a day?
Oh my goodness, is that like 22 miles maybe?
I can't even imagine. So where do you, is there enough places along the way? You can't carry enough food in your backpack with that.
There are more and more places. You know, there are more places being built this year when I was walking. It was to accommodate the increase. Like last year, I think 200,000 pilgrims came through Santiago or processed through Santiago.
Wow.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
And that mostly is between mid-June and October. Early May is not so bad generally. But there were a lot of moments coming into a village where there was no place to stay. Because it's a holiday weekend, there were a lot of people walking.
So I never even thought of that. What happens if everything's full? What do you do?
Well, you resist the urge to cry.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're at that time, you're ready to stop.
Yeah.
But you have to get your mind around continuing. And you do have options. It's not impossible, but they're not the options you want to think about, because You want to walk to the next place. You want to just roll into the village and find a place to sleep. There's a lovely freedom in that for your mind as well. But that's not the reality towards the end of May, getting into June. It was getting more and more difficult to find a place. So there are a couple things. You know, in one instance, people were taking taxis to the next village.
Uh-huh.
Another instance, you'd take a bus. Another time, I actually booked ahead. There were moments where I would just get a feeling in the early part of the day, like, you know, like a nudge.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, it was like if Spirit could dial my phone, it was going to do that. But I was like, okay, I'll do it, you know, and I'm glad I did, because when I got into the village, it was an exhausting 18-mile, almost 18-kilometer walk in the mountains, and with a severe downhill for like a couple of hours. And I already had 3 blisters starting, and I had fortunately called ahead and got the last room. And when I arrived, there were like all these people almost in tears because they had no place to stay. The next village was 5 kilometers away. It was getting, you know, late in the afternoon. There was no guarantee there would be accommodations there either. So you can, I think after that point was not that was a little soon for me to start doing that, but at one point I did start splitting my pack because I had problems. The blisters did heal eventually. Then I had problems with my knee because the pack was just too heavy.
Did you at those points think maybe I should just call it quits?
I never thought about calling it quits, but what it did is really taught me that I didn't have a lot of time to wait. If I felt something like a twinge in the knee or a hot spot in the foot or anything like that, I had to stop like in the moment I felt it and take care of it. Mm-hmm. Wrap the foot, tape it, you know, rub the tendons, whatever needed to happen, because by if you wait even 20 minutes, half an hour, and you still walk on it, you know, by the time you actually get to where you're going, you've got a problem to deal with. And mm-hmm. I saw people literally with feet so bad, I don't know how they kept walking. And one person was down in a village for 8 days, you know, just could not go anywhere. The tendonitis was so bad. So I was seeing a lot around me. And for myself, I just took care of things, you know.
Your knowledge of body work come in handy?
It did, but there's only so much you can do for yourself. Mm-hmm. And it really helped me keep my feet strong. You know, I knew how to work out the tendonitis if I could feel it, you know, and I actually worked on other people too, you know, when I saw that they were having difficulties. And I learned how to wrap the feet for the blisters and stuff like that, you know, and that was all really helpful knowledge. I would say for the most part, when those things happen, instead of thinking I'm not going to finish, it was more like, well, okay, let me cut back my miles. Maybe I'll just walk less, mm-hmm. Get to the next place, you know, a little bit sooner, and put my feet up, you know, take care of things a little differently. And I learned about compete and all those things that you need to keep in your backpack.
So we've only got about 4 minutes left. So I wanted to ask you, like, the highlight. I mean, this is, you know, an experience that is a spiritual experience, a physical experience, obviously. Where did you get to that point where did you feel some elation or, you know, sometimes actually exhausting the body, freeze the mind? Did you get, you know, almost zen-like sometimes? Did you get to that point along the walk?
There were many moments that were extremely difficult, like where my body just, we're in the middle of nowhere, my body wanted to stop. Like, the hips were locking down, the knees were done, and I was nowhere close to the village that I could see. And in those moments, it went from like, wow, isn't this incredibly beautiful, look where I'm at, to, oh my gosh, my body doesn't want to keep moving, and I'm not even close. Like, how far is it? I'm like, I need a sign, you know. Then you're praying to anything that will listen, anyone. You get, you know, then go to that, and then you calm down, and you're like, okay, all right. And then about that moment, every single time, there would be like a gentleman, like in his probably 80s, 90s, you know, coming around the bend with just his little sports jacket and his cap, his old Spanish cap. And I'd be like, ¿Dónde está? You know, it was like, where is the, you know, village? And he'd look at me and he'd be like, it's just 1 kilometer away. And this happened 4 times.
Wow.
The same kind of scenario.
Wow.
So I kind of always felt that was just Piero a little bit. Yeah. You know, coming around to let me
guardian
know
angel.
That I'm close.
Wow.
So yeah, there were, you know, there's the physical difficulties is one thing, but I think the difficulties of the mind are the thing that you don't expect in the Camino. And that's really where your growth is. It's where I found mine was. And at 43 days to process through a lot of stuff and really see what happens when the difficult moments, you know, they come and you have to deal with it on your own, in your own way. And
what was that final moment when you finally made it to Santiago?
The final moment, it was bittersweet in a way, because you're like, wow, it's over. Now what? You know, there was that moment, and I had arrived early because one of my Camino friends, Timothy, I call him Timoteum, which is his Latin name, from the Compostela certificate, he had offered me a breakfast at the 5-star Parador right there that he was staying in for 2 days if I got there early enough. I got up at 4 a.m. to make sure that I was there for that breakfast. But it was so early, nobody was in the piazza yet. It was very quiet. The hustle and bustle of other pilgrims arriving wasn't there yet. And So it was a little like, it was a moment of, I wasn't high or low. I was really, it was just like, so this is it. And I was like, okay, let me go get my certificate, get my breakfast, and then go to High Mass, you know, for the benediction, which was amazing.
Wow.
Yeah, the bishop was presiding that day, which is unusual, so everybody was dressed in red, and the what they call the bota fumero, the censer, that takes 8 men to move that through the whole nave, you know, from north to south, and that was being used during the ceremony that day as well. So it was a very special day to arrive and feel the elation of that. And of course, once all my friends were starting to arrive later and we all kind of got together, it was just a great celebration.
Well, it's an amazing journey. I encourage you to write a book. I think I did. But I think you have a very interesting story, and you sound like so much stronger for doing it.
Yeah.
Do you feel stronger for that?
Yeah, totally. Physically, yes, for sure. You know, I had muscles I've never seen except for on clients. I like, it's my favorite statement. But I also really came home to myself. Like, I got, by the end, I trusted myself completely and my choices, my perceptions of things. And
it's a beautiful story.
It was wonderful.
Well, Kathy, I want to thank you for making this show possible. People can reach you at Captivating Journeys at 244-1414. They even just want to have some information, you know, maybe talk about maybe what could be happening, some adventures they could create with you.
Yeah, just give us a call or go to our website at captivatingjourneys.com.
And it's a nice gift for Christmas.
We do give certificates.
You do give certificates. Yeah. Well, that's a nice gift someone could give. I mean, that's an adventure of a lifetime waiting for people to embrace. I really want to thank you, Stevie. Just beautiful stories. I loved you coming in and sharing your story and opening yourself up to your adventure. I haven't had anyone talk about it on the show before, so it was really a beautiful experience sharing it. So thank you so much for coming in today
Thank you.
To the Travel Angel Radio Show.